stupid, so willfully dumb. She would summon her father's voice. If you don't control your temper will control you. But now the red fissure was widening, and she felt the old urge to throw things, to scratch skin until the blood came sweating out. Did you ask her who did it? Yes, of course, Ginny said. She won't say. She's scared. Piper remembered how she'd first thought the mother and baby lying beside the road was a bag of garbage. And that, of course, was what they'd been to whoever did this. She stood up. I'm going to talk to her. That might not be such a good idea right now, Ginny said. She's had a sedative and...
Let her take her shot, Twitch said.
His face was pale, his hands were knotted between his knees. The knuckles cracked repeatedly.
And make it a good one, Rev.
13. Sammy's eyes were at half-mast. They opened slowly when Piper sat down beside her bed.
You were the one who...
Yes, Piper said, taking her hand. My name is Piper Libby.
Thank you, Sammy said.
Her eyes began to drift closed again.
Thank me by telling me the names of the men who raped you.
In the dim room, warm with the hospital's air conditioning shut down, Sammy shook her head.
They said they'd hurt me if I told.
She glanced at Piper. It was a cow-like glance full of dumb resignation.
They might hurt little Walter, too.
Piper nodded.
I understand you're frightened, she said. Now, tell me who they were. Give me the names. Didn't you hear me?
Looking away from Piper now.
They said they would hurt.
Piper had no time for this. The girl would zone out on her. She grabbed Sammy's wrist.
I want those names, and you're going to give them to me. I don't dare.
Sammy began to ooze tears.
You're going to do it, because if I hadn't come along, you might be dead now.
She paused, then drove the dagger the rest of the way in. She might regret it later, but not now. Right now, the girl in the bed was only an obstacle standing between her and what she needed to know.
Not to mention your baby. He might be dead, too. I saved your life, I saved his, and I want those names. No.
But the girl was weakening now, and part of the Reverend Piper Libby was actually enjoying this. Later, she'd be disgusted. Later, she'd think, you're not that much different from those boys. Forcing is forcing. But now, yes, there was pleasure, just as there had been pleasure in tearing the treasured poster from the wall and ripping it to shreds.
I like it because it is bitter, she thought, and because it is my heart.
She leaned over the crying girl.
Dig the wax out of your ears, Sammy, because you need to hear this. What they've done once, they'll do again. And when they do, when some other woman shows up here with a bloody snatch and possibly pregnant with a rapist child, I will come to you and I will say,
No!
Stop!
You were part of it. You were right there, cheering them on.
No! Sammy cried. Not me, that was Georgia. Georgia was the one cheering them on.
Piper felt cold disgust.
A woman. A woman had been there. In her head, the red fissure opened wider. Soon, it would begin to spew lava.
Give me the names, she said. And Sammy did.
14. Jackie Weddington and Linda Everett were parked outside Food City. It was closing at 5 p.m. instead of 8. Randolph had sent them there thinking the early closing might cause trouble. A ridiculous idea because the supermarket was almost empty. There were hardly a dozen cars in the parking lot, and the few remaining shoppers were moving in a slow daze, as if sharing the same bad dream. The two officers saw only one cashier, a teenager named Bruce Yardley. The kid was taking currency and writing chits instead of running credit cards. The meat counter was looking depleted, but there was still plenty of chicken, and most of the canned and dry goods shelves were fully stocked. They were waiting for the last customers to leave when Linda's cell phone rang. She looked at the caller ID and felt a little stab of fear in her stomach. It was Marta Edmonds, who kept Janelle and Judy when Linda and Rusty were both working, as they had been almost nonstop since the dome came down. She hit callback.
Marta, she said, praying it was nothing.
Marta asking if it was okay for her to take the girls down to the common, something like that. Everything all right? Well, yes, that is, I guess, so. Linda hating the worry she heard in Marta's voice. But you know that seizure thing? Oh, God, did she have one? I think so, Marta said, then hurried on. They're perfectly okay now, in the other room, coloring. What happened, tell me. They were on the swings. I was doing my flowers, getting them ready for winter. Marta, please, Linda said, and Jackie laid a hand on her arm. I'm sorry. Audie started to bark, so I turned around. I said, honey, you all right? She didn't answer, just got out of the swing and sat down underneath, you know, where there's a little dip from all the feet. She didn't fall out or anything, just sat down. She was staring straight ahead and doing that lip-smacking thing you told me to watch for. I ran over, kind of shook her, and she said, let me think. Here it comes, Linda thought. Stop Halloween. You have to stop Halloween. But no, it was something else entirely. She said, the pink stars are falling, the pink stars are falling in lines. Then she said, it's so dark and everything smells bad. Then she woke up and now everything's fine. Thank God for that, Linda said, and spared a thought for her five-year-old. Is Judy okay? Did it upset her? There was a long pause on the line, and then Marta said, oh. Oh, what does that mean, oh? It was Judy, Linda. Not Janelle. This time it was Judy. 15. I want to play that other game you said, Aiden had told Carolyn Sturges when they had stopped on the common to talk to Rusty. The other game she had in mind was Red Light, although Carolyn had only the slightest recollection of the rules. Not surprising, since she hadn't played it since she was 6 or 7. But once she was standing against a tree in the commodious backyard of the Passionage, the rules came back to her, and unexpectedly to Thurston, who seemed not only willing to play, but eager. Remember, he instructed the children, who somehow seemed to have missed the pleasures of Red Light themselves. She can count to 10 as fast as she wants to, and if she catches you moving when she turns around, you have to go all the way back.
She won't catch me, Alice said.
Me either, Aiden said stoutly.
We'll see about that, Carolyn said, and turned her face to the tree.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, red light.
She whirled around. Alice was standing with a smile on her mouth and one leg extended in a big old giant step. Thurston, also smiling, had his hands extended in Phantom of the Opera claws. She caught the slightest movement from Aiden, but didn't even think about sending him back. He looked happy, and she had no intention of spoiling that.
Good, she said. Good little statues. Here comes round two.
She turned to the tree and counted again, invaded by the old, childishly delicious fear of knowing people were moving in while her back was turned.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, red light!
She whirled. Alice was now only 20 paces away. Aiden was 10 paces or so behind her, trembling on one foot, a scab on his knee very visible. Thirst was behind the boy, one hand on his chest, like an orator, smiling. Alice was going to be the one to catch her, but that was all right. In the second game, the girl would be it, and her brother would win. She and Thirst would see to it. She turned to the tree again.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Then Alice screamed. Carolyn turned and saw Aiden Appleton lying on the ground. At first she thought he was still trying to play the game. One knee, the one with the scab on it, was up, as if he were trying to run on his back. His wide eyes were staring at the sky. His lips were folded into a poochy little O. There was a dark spot spreading on his shorts. She rushed to him.
What's wrong with him? Alice asked.
Carolyn could see all the stress of the terrible weekend crushing in on her face.
Is he all right?
Aiden? Thurs asked. You okay, big fella?
Aiden went on trembling, his lips seeming to suck at an invisible straw. His bent leg came down, then kicked out. His shoulders twitched. He's having some kind of seizure, Carolyn said, probably from overexcitement. I think he'll come out of it if we just gave him a few
The pink stars are falling, Aiden said. They make lines behind them. It's pretty. It's scary. Everyone is watching. No treats, only tricks. Hard to breathe. He calls himself the chef. It's his fault. He's the one.
Carolyn and Thurston looked at each other. Alice was kneeling by her brother, holding his hand.
Pink stars, Aiden said. They fall, they fall, they f—
Wake up,
Alice shouted into his face.
Stop scaring us.
Thurston Marshall touched her shoulder gently.
Honey, I don't think that's helping.
Alice paid him no mind.
Wake up, you crap head.
And Aiden did. He looked at his sister's tear-streaked face, puzzled. Then he looked at Carolyn and smiled. The sweetest goddamn smile she had ever seen in her life.
Did I win?
He asked. 16. The Jenny in the town hall supply shed was badly maintained. Someone had shoved an old-timey galvanized tin wash basin under it to catch the dripping oil. And Rusty guessed about as energy efficient as Big Jim Rennie's Hummer, but he was more interested in the silver tank attached to it. Barbie looked briefly at the generator, grimaced at the smell, then moved to the tank. It isn't as big as I would have expected, he said, although it was a hell of a lot bigger than the canisters they used at Sweetbriar, or the one he had changed out for Brenda Perkins. It's called municipal size, Rusty said. I remember that from the town meeting last year. Sanders and Rennie made a big deal of how the smaller tanks were going to save us yay bucks during these times of costly energy. Each one holds 800 gallons. Which means a weight of, what, 6,400 pounds? Rusty nodded. Plus the weight of the tank. It's a lot to lift. You'd need a forklift or a hydraulic power step, but not to move. A Ram pickup is rated for 6,800 pounds, and it could probably carry more. One of these mid-sized tanks would fit in the bed, too. Sticking out the end a little bit is all. Rusty shrugged. Hang a red flag from it, and you're good to go. This is the only one here, Barbie said. When it's gone, the town hall lights go out. Unless Rennie and Sanders know where there are more, Rusty agreed. And I'm betting they do. Barbie ran a hand over the blue stenciling on the tank. CRHOSP. This is what you lost? We didn't lose it. It was stolen. That's what I'm thinking. Only there should be 5 more of our tanks in here, because we're missing a total of 6. Barbie surveyed the long shed. Despite the stored plows and cartons of reserve parts, the place looked empty, especially around the generator. Never mind what got kited from the hospital. Where's the rest of the town's tanks? I don't know. And what could they be using them for? I don't know, Rusty said. But I mean to find out.
Pink Stars Falling. 1.
Barbie and Rusty stepped outside and breathed deeply of the open air. It had a smoky tang from the recently extinguished fires west of town, but seemed very fresh after the exhaust fumes in the shed. A lackadaisical little breeze cat's pawed their cheeks. Barbie was carrying the Geiger counter in a brown shopping bag he'd found in the fallout shelter. This shit will not stand, Rusty said. His face was set and grim. What are you going to do about it? Barbie asked. Now, nothing. I'm going back to the hospital and do rounds. Tonight, though, I intend to knock on Jim Rennie's door and ask for a goddamn explanation. He better have one. And he better have the rest of our propane as well, because we're going to be dead out of the hospital by the day after tomorrow, even with every non-essential shut down.
This might be over by the day after tomorrow.
Do you believe it will be? Instead of answering the question, Barbie said, Selectman Rennie could be a dangerous man to press right about now. Just now? That tags you for a town newbie like nothing else could. I've been hearing that about Big Jim for the 10,000 or so years he's been running this town. He either tells people to get lost or pleads patience. For the good of the town, he says. That's number one on his hit parade. Town meeting in March is a joke. An article to authorize a new sewer system? Sorry, the town can't afford the taxes. An article to authorize more commercial zoning? Great idea. The town needs the revenue. Let's build a Walmart out on 117. The University of Maine Small Town Environmental Study says there's too much gray water in Chester Pond. The selectmen recommend tabling discussion because everybody knows all those scientific studies are run by radical, humanist, bleeding-heart atheists. But the hospital is for the good of the town, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I would.
Barbie was a little bemused by this outburst. Rusty stared at the ground with his hands in his back pockets. Then he looked up.
I understand the president tapped you to take over. I think it's high time you did so.
It's an idea, Barbie smiled. Except, Rennie and Sanders have got their police force. Where's mine? Before Rusty could reply, his cell phone rang. He flipped it open and looked at the little window. Linda, what? He listened.
All right, I understand. If you're sure they're both okay now. And you're sure it was Judy, not Janelle?
He listened some more, then said, I think this is actually good news. I saw two other kids this morning, both with transient seizures that passed off quickly, long before I saw them. And both fine afterward. Had calls on three more.
Ginny T. took another one. It could be a side effect of whatever force is powering the dome.
He listened.
Because I didn't have a chance to, he said.
His tone patient, non-confrontational. Barbie could imagine the question which had prompted that. Kids have been having seizures all day, and now you tell me?
You're picking the kids up? Rusty asked.
He listened.
Okay, that's good. If you sense anything wrong, call me ASAP. I'll come on the run. And make sure Audie stays with him.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Love you too.
He hooked the phone on his belt and ran both hands through his hair hard enough to make his eyes look briefly Chinese.
Jesus, jumped up, Christ.
Who's Audie?
Our golden retriever.
Tell me about these seizures. Rusty did so, not omitting what Janny had said about Halloween and what Judy had said about pink stars.
The Halloween thing sounds like what the Dinsmore boy was raving about, Barbie said. Does, doesn't it?
What about the other kids? Any of them talking about Halloween or pink stars?
The parents I saw today said their kids babbled while the seizure was ongoing, but they were too freaked to pay any attention.
The kids themselves didn't remember?
The kids didn't even know they'd had seizures.
Is that normal?
It's not abnormal.
Any chance your younger daughter was copying the older one? Maybe, I don't know, vying for attention? Rusty hadn't considered this, hadn't had the time, really. Now he did.
Possible, but not likely.
He nodded to the old-fashioned yellow Geiger counter in the bag.
You going prospecting with that thing?
Not me, Barbie said. This baby's town property and the powers that be don't like me much. I wouldn't want to be caught with it. He held the bag out to Rusty.
Can't. I'm just too busy right now.
I know, Barbie said, and told Rusty what he wanted him to do. Rusty listened closely, smiling a little.
Okay, he said. Works for me. What are you going to be doing while I'm running your errands?
Cooking dinner at Sweetbriar. Tonight's special is chicken a la Barbara. Want me to send some up to the hospital?
Sweet,
Rusty said.
Two.
On his way back to Kathy Russell, Rusty stopped by the Democrat's office and handed off the Geiger counter to Julia Shumway. She listened as he relayed Barbie's instructions, smiling faintly.
The man knows how to delegate, I'll say that for him. I'll see to this with pleasure.
Rusty thought of cautioning her to be careful about who saw the town's Geiger counter in her possession, but didn't need to. The bag had disappeared into the knee-hole of her desk. On his way to the hospital, he reached Ginny Tomlinson and asked her about the seizure call she'd taken.
Little kid named Jimmy Wicker, the grandfather called it in. Bill Wicker?
Rusty knew him. Bill delivered their mail.
He was taking care of Jimmy while the boy's mom went to gas up their car. They're almost out of regular at the gas and grocery, by the way. And Johnny Carver's had the nerve to jack the price of regular to $11 a gallon. 11.
Rusty bore this patiently, thinking he could have had his conversation with Ginny face to face. He was almost back to the hospital. When she was done complaining, he asked her if little Jimmy had said anything while he was seizing.
Yes, indeed. Bill said he babbled quite a bit. I think it was something about pink stars, or Halloween, or maybe I'm getting it confused with what Rory Dinsmore said after he was shot. People have been talking about that.
Of course they have, Rusty thought grimly, and they'll be talking about this, too, if they find out, as they probably will.
All right, he said. Thanks, Ginny.
When you coming back, Red Rider?
Almost there now. Good. Because we have a new patient, Sammy Bushy.
She was raped.
Rusty groaned.
It gets better. Piper Libby brought her in. I couldn't get the names of the doers out of the girl, but I think Piper did. She went out of here like her hair was on fire, and her ass...
A pause. Ginny yawned loud enough for Rusty to hear.
Her ass was catching.
Ginny, my love, when's the last time you got some sleep?
I'm fine.
Go home. Are you kidding? Sounding aghast. No. Go home, sleep. No setting the alarm, either. Then an idea struck him. But, stop by Sweetbriar Rose on the way, why don't you? They're having chicken. I heard it from a reliable source.
The bushy girl.
I'll be checking on her in 5 minutes. What you're going to do is make like a bee and buzz. He closed his phone before she could protest again. 3. Big Jim Rennie felt remarkably good for a man who had committed murder the night before. This was partially because he did not see it as murder, no more than he had seen the death of his late wife as murder. It was cancer that had taken her, inoperable. Yes, he had probably given her too many of the pain pills over the last week, and in the end he'd still had to help her with a pillow over her face. But lightly, ever so lightly, slowing her breathing, easing her into the arms of Jesus. But he had done it out of love and kindness. What had happened to Reverend Coggins was a bit more brutal, admittedly. But the man had been so bullish, so completely unable to put the town's welfare ahead of his own.
Well, he's eating dinner with Christ the Lord tonight, Big Jim said. Roast beef mashed with gravy.
Apple crisp for dessert. He himself was eating a large plate of fettuccine Alfredo, courtesy of the Stouffer's company. A lot of cholesterol, he supposed, but there was no Dr. Haskell around to nag him about it.
I outlasted you, you old poop.
Big Jim told his empty study and laughed good-naturedly. His plate of pasta and a glass filled with milk, Big Jim Rennie did not drink alcohol, were set on his desk blotter. He often ate in the study, and he saw no need to change that simply because Lester Coggins had met his end here. Besides, the room was once more squared away and spandy clean. Oh, he supposed one of those investigation units, like the ones on TV, would be able to find plenty of blood splatter with their luminol and special lights and things. But none of those people was going to be here in the immediate future. As for Pete Randolph doing any sleuthing in the matter, the idea was a joke. Randolph was an idiot. But, Big Jim told the empty room in a lecturely tone, he's my idiot. He slurped up the last few strands of pasta, mopped his considerable chin with a napkin, then once more began to jot notes on the yellow legal pad beside the blotter. He had jotted plenty of notes since Saturday. There was so much to do. And if the dome stayed in place, there would be more still. Big Jim sort of hoped it would remain in place. At least for a while. The dome offered challenges to which he felt certain he could rise, with God's help, of course. The first order of business was to consolidate his hold on the town. For that, he needed more than a scapegoat. He needed a boogeyman. The obvious choice was Barbara, the man the Democrat Party's commie-in-chief had tapped to replace James Rennie. The study door opened. When Big Jim looked up from his notes, his son was standing there. His face was pale and expressionless. There was something not quite right about Junior lately. As busy as he was with the town's affairs and their other enterprise that had also kept him busy, Big Jim realized this. But he felt confident in the boy just the same. Even if Junior let him down, Big Jim was sure he could handle it. He'd spent a lifetime making his own luck. That wasn't going to change now. Besides, the boy had moved the body. That made him part of this, which was good. The essence of small-town life, in fact. In a small town, everybody was supposed to be a part of everything. How did that silly song put it? We all support the team.
Son, he asked. All right? I'm fine, Junior said.
He wasn't, but he was better. The latest poisonous headache finally lifting. Being with his girlfriends had helped, as he'd known it would. The McCain pantry didn't smell so good.
but after he'd sat there a while holding their hands, he'd gotten used to it. He thought he could even come to like that smell.
Did you find anything in his apartment?
Yes. Junior told him what he had found.
That's excellent, son, really excellent. And are you ready to tell me where you put him?
Junior shook his head slowly back and forth, but his eyes stayed in exactly the same place while he did it, pinned on his father's face.
It was a little eerie.
You don't need to know. I told you that. It's a safe place, and that's enough.
So now you're telling me what I need to know?
But he said it without his usual heat.
In this case, yes. Big Jim considered his son carefully.
Are you sure you're all right? You look pale.
I'm fine, just a headache. It's going now.
Why not have something to eat? There are a few more fettuccines in the freezer, and the microwave does a great job on them.
He smiled.
Might as well enjoy them while we can.
The dark, considering eyes dropped for a moment to the puddle of white sauce on Big Jim's plate, then rose again to his father's face. Not hungry. When should I find the bodies?
Bodies? Big Jim stared. What do you mean, bodies?
Junior smiled, lips lifting just enough to show the tips of his teeth. Never mind. It'll help your credit if you're surprised like everyone else. Let's put it this way. Once we pull the trigger, this town will be ready to hang Barbie from a sour apple tree. When do you want to do it? Tonight? Because that'll work. Big Jim considered the question. He looked down at his yellow pad. It was crammed with notes and splattered with Alfredo sauce. But only one was circled. Newspaper bitch. Not tonight. We can use him for more than Coggins if we play this right. And if the dome comes down while you're playing it?
We'll be fine, Big Jim said,
thinking, and if Mr. Barbara is somehow able to squirm free of the frame, not likely, but cockroaches have a way of finding cracks when the lights go on. There's always you.
You and those other bodies.
Now get yourself something to eat, even if it's only a salad. But Junior didn't move. Don't wait too long, Dad, he said.
I won't.
Junior considered it, considered him, with those dark eyes that seemed so strange now. Then seemed to lose interest. He yawned. I'm going up to my room and sleep a while. I'll eat later.
Just make sure you do. You're getting too thin.
Thin is in, his son replied, and offered a hollow smile that was even more disquieting than his eyes.
To Big Jim, it looked like a skull smile.
It made him think of the fellow who now just called himself the chef, as if his previous life as Phil Bushy had been canceled.
When Junior left the room, Big Jim breathed a sigh of relief, without even being aware of it. He picked up his pen. So much to do. He would do it and do it well. It was not impossible that when this thing was over, his picture would be on the cover of Time magazine. 4. With her generator still running, although it wouldn't be for much longer unless she could find some more LP canisters, Brenda Perkins was able to fire up her husband's printer and make a hard copy of everything in the Vader file. The incredible list of offenses Howie had compiled, and which he had apparently been about to act on at the time of his death, seemed more real to her on paper than they had on the computer screen. And the more she looked at them, the more they seemed to fit the Jim Rennie she'd known for most of her life. She had always known he was a monster, just not how big a monster. Even the stuff about Coggins's Jesus-jumping church fit. Although if she was reading this right, it was really not a church at all, but a big old holy Maytag that washed money instead of clothes. Money from a drug manufacturing operation that was, in her husband's words, maybe one of the biggest in the history of the United States. But there were problems, which both Police Chief Howie Duke Perkins and the state AG had acknowledged. The problems were why the evidence-gathering phase of Operation Vader had gone on as long as it had. Jim Rennie wasn't just a big monster. He was a smart monster.
That was why he had always been content to remain the second selectman. He had Andy Sanders to break trail for him. And to wear a target, that too. For a long time, Andy was the only one against whom Howie had had hard evidence. He was the front man, and probably didn't even know it. Cheery, glad-handing, dumb shit that he was.
Andy was first selectman, first deacon at Holy Redeemer, first in the hearts of the townsfolk, and out front on a trail of corporate documents that finally disappeared into the obfuscatory financial swamps of Nassau and Grand Cayman Island. If Howie and the state attorney general had moved too soon, he would also have been first to get his picture taken while holding a number. Maybe the only one, should he believe Big Jim's inevitable promises that all would be well if Andy just kept mum. And he probably would. Who was better at dummying up than a dummy? Last summer, things had begun working toward what Howie had seen as the endgame. That was when Rennie's name had started showing up on some of the paperwork the AG had obtained. Most notably, that of a Nevada corporation called Town Ventures. The Town Ventures money had disappeared west instead of east, not into the Caribbean, but into mainland China, a country where the key ingredients of decongestant drugs could be bought in bulk with few or any questions. Why would Rennie allow such exposure? Howie Perkins had been able to think of only one reason. The money had gotten too big too fast for one holy washing machine. Rennie's name had subsequently appeared on papers concerning half a dozen other fundamentalist churches in the Northeast. Town Ventures and the other churches, not to mention half a dozen other religious radio stations and AM talkers, none as big as WCIK, were Rennie's first real mistakes. They left dangling strings. Strings could be pulled, and sooner or later, usually sooner, everything unraveled.
You couldn't let go, could you? Brenda thought, as she sat behind her husband's desk studying the papers. You'd made millions, maybe tens of millions, and the risks were becoming outrageous, but you still couldn't let go. Like a monkey who traps himself because he won't let go of the food. You were sitting on a damn fortune, and you just kept on living in that old three-story and selling cars at that pit of yours out on 119. Why? But she knew. It wasn't the money, it was the town. What he saw as his town. Sitting on a beach somewhere in Costa Rica, presiding over a guarded estate in Namibia, Big Jim would become Small Jim. Because a man without a sense of purpose, even one whose bank accounts are stuffed with money, is always a small man. If she confronted him with what she had, could she make a deal with him? Force him out in return for her silence? She wasn't sure. And she dreaded the confrontation. It would be ugly, possibly dangerous. She would want to have Julia Shumway with her, and Barbie. Only Dale Barbara was now wearing his own target. Howie's voice, calm but firm, spoke up in her head. You can afford to wait a little while. I was waiting for a few final items of proof myself. But I wouldn't wait too long, honey. Because the longer this siege goes on, the more dangerous he'll become. She thought of Howie starting to back down the driveway, then stopping to put his lips on hers in the sunshine, his mouth almost as well known to her as her own, and certainly as well loved, caressing the side of her throat as he did it, as if he knew the end was coming, and one last touch would have to pay for all. An easy and romantic conceit for sure, but she almost believed it, and her eyes filled with tears. Suddenly, the papers and all the machinations contained therein seemed less important. Even the dome didn't seem very important. What mattered was the hole that had appeared so suddenly in her life, sucking out the happiness she had taken for granted. She wondered if poor, dumb Andy Sanders felt the same way. She supposed he did. I'll give it 24 hours. If the dome's still in place tomorrow night, I'll go to Rennie with this stuff. With copies of this stuff, and tell him he has to resign in favor of Dale Barbara. Tell him that if he doesn't, he's going to read all about his drug operation in the paper. Tomorrow,
she murmured, and closed her eyes. 2 minutes later, she was asleep in Howie's chair. In Chester's Mill, the supper hour had come. Some meals, including chicken a la king for 100 or so, were cooked on electric or gas ranges, courtesy of the generators in town that were still working. But there were also people who had turned to their wood stoves, either to conserve their jennies or because wood was now all they had. The smoke rose in the still air from hundreds of chimneys and spread. 5. After delivering the Geiger counter, the recipient took it willingly, even eagerly, and promised to begin prospecting with it early on Tuesday. Julia headed for Burpee's department store with Horace on his leash. Romeo had told her he had a pair of brand new photocopiers in storage, both still in their original shipping cartons. She was welcome to both. "I also got a little propane tucked away," he said, giving Horace a pat. "I'll see you get what you need, for as long as I can, at least. We got to keep that newspaper running, am I right? More important than ever, don't you think?" It was exactly what she taught, and Julia had told him so. She had also planted a kiss on his cheek. "I owe you for this, Romy. I'll be expecting a big discount on my weekly advertising circular when this is over." He had then tapped the side of his nose with a forefinger, as if they had a great big secret. Maybe they did. As she left, her cell phone chirruped. She pulled it out of her pants pocket. "Hello, this is Julia."
"Good evening, Miss Shumway."
"Oh, Colonel Cox, how wonderful to hear your voice," she said brightly. "You can't imagine how thrilled we country mice are to get out-of-town calls. How's life outside the dome?"
"Life in general is probably fine," he said. "Where I am, it's on the shabby side. You know about the missiles."
"Watch them hit and bounce off. They lit a fine fire on your side."
"It's not my..."
"And a fairly good one on ours."
"I'm calling for Colonel Barbara," Cox said, "who should be carrying his own goddamn phone by now."
"Goddamn right," she cried, still in her brightest tone. "And people in goddamn hell should have goddamn ice water." She stopped in front of the gas and grocery, now shut up tight. The hand-lettered sign in the window read, "Hours of op tomorrow, 11 a.m., 2 p.m. Get here early."
"Ms. Shumway..."
"We'll discuss Colonel Barbara in a minute," Julia said. "Right now, I want to know two things. First, when is the press going to be allowed at the dome? Because the people of America deserve more than the government's spin on this, don't you think?" She expected him to say he did not think, that there would be no New York Times or CNN at the dome in the foreseeable future, but Cox surprised her.
"Probably by Friday, if none of the other tricks up our sleeve work. What's the other thing you want to know, Ms. Shumway? Make it brief, because I'm not a press officer. That's another pay grade."
"You called me, so you're stuck with me. Suck it up, Colonel."
"Miss Shumway, with all due respect, yours is not the only cell phone in Chester's Mill I can reach out and touch."
"I'm sure that's true, but I don't think Barbie will talk to you if you shine me on. He's not particularly happy with his new position as prospective stockade commandant."
Cox sighed. "What's your question?"
"I want to know the temperature on the south or east side of the dome. A true temperature, meaning away from the fire you guys set."
"Why?"
"Do you have that information or not? I think you do, or can get it. I think you're sitting in front of a computer screen right now, and you have access to everything, probably including my underwear size." She paused. "And if you say 16, this call is over."
"Are you exhibiting your sense of humor, Miss Shumway, or are you always this way?"
"I'm tired and scared. Chalk it up to that." There was a pause on Cox's end. She thought she heard the click of computer keys. Then he said,
"It's 47 Fahrenheit in Castle Rock. Will that do?"
"Yes." The disparity wasn't as bad as she had feared, but still considerable. "I'm looking at the thermometer in the window of the Mill Gas and Grocery. It says 58. That's an 11-degree difference between locations less than 20 miles apart. Unless there's a hell of a big warm front pushing through western Maine this evening, I'd say something's going on here. Do you agree?"
He didn't answer her question, but what he did say took her mind off it. "We're going to try something else. Around 9 this evening. That's what I wanted to tell Barbie."
"One hopes Plan B will work better than Plan A at this moment. I believe the president's appointee is feeding the multitudes at Sweetbriar Rose.
Chicken a la king is the rumor. She could see the lights down the street, and her belly rumbled.
Will you listen and pass on a message?
And she heard what he did not add. You contentious bitch.
Happy to, she said, smiling because she was a contentious bitch when she had to be.
We're going to try an experimental acid, a hydrofluoric compound, man-made, 9 times as corrosive as the ordinary stuff.
Living better through chemistry.
I'm told you could theoretically burn a hole 2 miles deep in the bedrock with it.
What highly amusing people you work for, Colonel.
We're going to try where Motton Road crosses. There was a rustle of paper. Where it crosses into Harlow. I expect to be there.
Then I'll tell Barbie to have someone else wash up.
Will you also be favoring us with your company, Miss Shumway? She opened her mouth to say, I wouldn't miss it, and that was when all hell broke loose up the street. What's going on there? Cox asked.
Julia didn't reply.
She closed her phone and stuck it in her pocket, already running toward the sound of yelling voices, and something else. Something that sounded like snarling.
The gunshot came while she was still half a block away.
6.
Piper went back to the parsonage and discovered Carolyn, Thurston, and the Appleton kids waiting there.
She was glad to see them, because they took her mind off Sammy Bushy.
At least temporarily. She listened to Carolyn's account of Aiden Appleton's seizure, but the boy seemed fine now, chowing ever deeper into a stack of Fig Newtons. When Carolyn asked if the boy should see a doctor, Piper said, Unless there's a recurrence, I think you can assume it was brought on by hunger and the excitement of the game.
Thurston smiled ruefully.
We were all excited, having fun.
When it came to possible lodging, Piper first thought of the McCain house, which was close by. Only she didn't know where their spare key might be hidden. Alice Appleton was on the floor, feeding Fig Newton crumbs to Clover. The shepherd was doing the old my muzzles on your ankle because I'm your best friend routine in between offerings.
This is the best dog I've ever seen, she told Piper. I wish we could have a dog.
I've got a dragon, Aiden offered.
He was sitting comfortably on Carolyn's lap.
Alice smiled indulgently.
That's his invisible F-R-E-I-N.
I see, Piper said.
She supposed they could always break a window at the McCain place. Needs must when the devil drives. But as she got up to check on the coffee, a better idea occurred. The Dummagens. I should have thought of them right away. They went to Boston for a conference. Coralie Dummagen asked me to water her plants while they're gone.
I teach in Boston, Thurston said. At Emerson, I edited the current issue of Plowshares.
And sighed.
The key is under a flower pot to the left of the door, Piper said. I don't believe they have a generator, but there's a wood stove in the kitchen.
She hesitated, thinking, city people.
Can you use a wood stove to cook on without setting the house on fire?
I grew up in Vermont, Thurston said. Was in charge of keeping the stoves lit, house and barn, until I went off to college. What goes around comes around, doesn't it?
And he sighed again. There'll be food in the pantry, I'm sure, Piper said. Carolyn nodded. That's what the janitor at the town hall said.
Also, Junior, Alice put in. He's a cop.
A foxy one.
Thurston's mouth turned down.
Alice's foxy cop assaulted me, he said. Him or the other one? I couldn't tell them apart myself.
Piper's eyebrows went up.
Punch Thurston in the stomach, Carolyn said quietly. Called us massholes, which I suppose we technically are, and laughed at us. For me, that was the worst part, how they laughed at us. They were better once they had the kids with them, but... She shook her head. They were out of control. And just like that, Piper was back to Sammy. She felt a pulse beginning to beat in the side of her neck. Very slow and hard, but she kept her voice even.
What was the other policeman's name?
Frankie, Carolyn said. Junior called him Frankie D. Do you know these guys?
You must, huh?
I know them, Piper said.
7. She gave the new makeshift family directions to the Dummagens. The house had the advantage of being near to Kathy Russell if the boy had another seizure, and sat a while at her kitchen table after they were gone, drinking tea. She did it slowly. Took a sip and set the cup down. Took a sip and set it down. Clover whined. He was tuned into her, and she supposed he could sense her rage. Maybe it changes my smell, makes it more acrid or something. A picture was forming, not a pretty one. A lot of new cops, very young cops, sworn in less than 48 hours ago and already running wild. The sort of license they had exhibited with Sammy Bushy and Thurston Marshall wouldn't spread to veteran cops like Henry Morrison and Jackie Weddington. At least she didn't think so. But to Fred Denton? Toby Whalen? Maybe. Probably. With Duke in charge, those guys had been all right. Not great. The kind of guys apt to lip you unnecessarily after a traffic stop, but all right. Certainly the best the town's budget could afford. But her mother had been wont to say, you buy cheap, you get cheap. And with Peter Randolph in charge, something had to be done. Only she had to control her temper. If she didn't, it would control her. She took the leash from the peg by the door. Clover was up at once, tail swishing, ears perked, eyes bright. Come on, you big log, we're going to lodge a complaint. Her shepherd was still licking Fig Newton crumbs from the side of his muzzle as she led him out the door. 8. Walking across the town common with Clover heeling neatly to her right, Piper felt she did have her temper under control. She felt that way until she heard the laughter. It came as she and Clover were approaching the police station. She observed the very fellows whose names she had gotten out of Sammy Bushy. De Lesseps, Thibodeau, Searles. Georgia Rue was also present. Georgia, who had egged them on, according to Sammy, do that bitch. Freddie Denton was there, too. They were sitting at the top of the stone PD steps, drinking sodas, gassing among themselves. Duke Perkins never would have allowed such a thing. And Piper reflected that if he could see them from wherever he was, he'd be rolling in his grave fast enough to set his own remains on fire. Mel Searles said something and they all broke up again, laughing and backslapping. Thibodeau had his arm around the Rue girl, the tips of his fingers on the side swell of her breast. She said something and they all laughed harder. It came to Piper that they were laughing about the rape. What a gall-dern good old time it had been. And after that, her father's advice never had a chance. The Piper who ministered to the poor and the sick, who officiated at marryings and buryings, who preached charity and tolerance on Sundays, was pushed rudely to the back of her mind, where she could only watch as though through a warped and wavery pane of glass. It was the other Piper who took over, the one who had trashed her room at 15, crying tears of rage rather than sorrow. There was a slate-paved square known as War Memorial Plaza between the town hall and the newer brick PD building. At its center was a statue of Ernie Calvert's father, Lucian Calvert, who had been awarded a posthumous Silver Star for heroic action in Korea. The names of other Chester's Mill war dead, going all the way back to the Civil War, were engraved on the statue's base. There were also two flagpoles, the stars and stripes at the top of one, and the state flag, with its farmer, sailor, and moose at the top of the other. Both hung limp in the reddening light of oncoming sunset. Piper Libby passed between the poles like a woman in a dream. Clover still heeling behind her right knee with his ears up. The officers atop the steps burst into another hearty roar of laughter, and she thought of trolls in one of the fairy stories her dad had sometimes read her. Trolls in a cave, gloating over piles of ill-gotten gold. Then they saw her, and quieted. "Good evening, Reverend," Mel Searles said, and got up, giving his belt a self-important little hitch as he did so. Standing in the presence of a lady, Piper thought. Did his mother teach him that? Probably. The fine art of rape he probably learned somewhere else. He was still smiling as she reached the steps, but then it faltered and grew tentative, so he must have seen her expression. Just what that expression might be, she didn't know. From the inside, her face felt frozen, immobile. She saw the biggest of them watching her closely. Thibodeau, his face as immobile as hers felt. He's like Clover, she thought. He smells it on me. The rage.
Reverend, Mel asked. Everything okay? There a problem?
She mounted the steps, not fast, not slow. Clover still healing neatly behind her right knee.
You bet there's a problem, she said, looking up at him.
What?
You, she said, you're the problem.
She pushed him. Mel wasn't expecting it. He was still holding his cup of soda. He went tumbling into Georgia Rue's lap, flailing his arms uselessly for balance. And for a moment, the soda was a dark manta ray hanging against the reddening sky. Georgia cried out in surprise as Mel landed on her. She sprawled backward, spilling her own soda. They went running across the wide granite slab in front of the double doors. Piper could smell either whiskey or bourbon. Their cokes had been spiked with what the rest of the town could no longer buy. No wonder they'd been laughing. The red fissure inside her head opened wider.
You can't, Frankie began, starting to get up himself. She pushed him.
In a galaxy far, far away, Clover, ordinarily the sweetest of dogs, was growling. Frankie went on his back, eyes wide and startled for a moment, looking like the Sunday schoolboy he once might have been.
Rape is the problem, Piper shouted. Rape.
Shut up, Carter said.
He was still sitting. And although Georgia was cowering against him, Carter remained calm. The muscles of his arms rippled below his short-sleeved blue shirt.
Shut up and get out of here right now. If you don't want to spend the night in a cell downstairs,
you're the one who'll be going into a cell, Piper said. All of you.
Make her shut up, Georgia said. She wasn't whimpering, but she was close.
Make her shut up, Cart.
Ma'am? Freddie Denton.
His uniform, shirt untucked and bourbon on his breath, Duke would have taken one look and fired his ass, fired all their asses. He started to get up, and this time he was the one who went sprawling, a look of surprise on his face that would have been comical under other circumstances. It was nice that they had been sitting while she was standing, made it easier. But oh, how her temples were thudding. She returned her attention to Thibodeau, the most dangerous one. He was still looking at her with maddening calm, as though she were a freak he'd paid a quarter to see in a sideshow tent. But he was looking up at her, and that was her advantage.
But it won't be a cell downstairs, she said, speaking directly to Thibodeau. It'll be in Shawshank, where they do to little playyard bullies like you what you did to that girl.
You stupid bitch, Carter said.
He spoke as if remarking on the weather. We weren't anywhere near her house.
That's right, Georgia said, sitting up again.
There was coke splattered on one of her cheeks, where a virulent case of teenage acne was fading, but still holding on to a few final outposts.
And besides, everyone knows Sammy Bushy is nothing but a lying lesbo cunt.
Piper's lips stretched in a smile. She turned it on Georgia, who recoiled from the crazy lady who had appeared so suddenly on the steps while they'd been having a nice sunsetter or two.
How did you know the lying lesbo cunt's name? I didn't say it.
Georgia's mouth dropped into an O of dismay. And for the first time, something flickered beneath Carter Thibodeau's calm. Whether fear or just annoyance, Piper didn't know. Frank de Lesseps got cautiously to his feet.
You better not go around spreading accusations you can't back up, Reverend Libby.
Nor assaulting police officers, Freddie Denton said. I'm willing to let it go this time. Everyone's under stress, but you have to cease and desist these accusations right now.
He paused, then added lamely, and the pushing, of course. Piper's gaze remained fixed on Georgia. Her right hand curled so tightly around the black plastic grip of Glover's leash it was throbbing. The dog stood with his forepaws spread and his head lowered, still growling. He sounded like a powerful outboard motor set to idle. The fur on his neck had bushed out enough to hide his collar.
How'd you know her name, Georgia? I just assumed.
Carter gripped her shoulder and squeezed it.
Shut up, babe.
And then to Piper, still not standing, because he doesn't want to be pushed back down, the coward. He said,
I don't know what kind of bee you've got in your Jesus bonnet, but we were all together last night at Alden Dinsmore's farm, trying to see if we could get anything out of the Soldier Boys station on 119, which we couldn't.
That's on the other side of town, from Bushy's.
He looked around at his friends.
Right, Frankie said.
Right.
Mel chimed in, looking at Piper distrustfully.
Yeah,
Georgia said. Carter's arm was around her again, and her moment of doubt was gone.
She looked at Piper defiantly. Georgie girl assumed it was Sammy you were yelling about, Carter said with that same infuriating calm, because Sammy's the biggest lying scumbucket in this town. Mel Searles yodeled laughter.
But you didn't use protection, Piper said.
Sammy had told her this, and when she saw Thibodeau's face tighten, she knew it was true.
You didn't use protection, and they rape-kitted her.
She had no idea if this was true and didn't care. She could see from their widening eyes that they believed it, and their belief was enough.
When they compare your DNA to what they found...
That's enough, Carter said. Shut it. She turned her furious smile on him.
No, Mr. Thibodeau, we are only getting started, my son.
Freddie Denton reached for her. She pushed him down, then felt her left arm caught and twisted. She turned and looked into Thibodeau's eyes. No calm there now. They were shining with rage.
Hello, my brother, she thought incoherently.
Fuck you, you fucking bitch, he remarked. And this time, she was the one who was pushed. Piper fell backward down the stairs, trying instinctively to tuck and roll, not wanting to hit her head on one of those stone risers, knowing they could smash her skull in, kill her, or worse, leave her a vegetable. She struck on her left shoulder instead, and there was a sudden howl of pain there. Familiar pain. She had dislocated that one playing high school soccer 20 years ago, and damned if she hadn't just done it again. Her legs flew over her head, and she turned a back somersault, wrenching her neck, coming down on her knees, and splitting the skin on both. She finally came to rest on her stomach and breasts. She had tumbled almost all the way to the bottom of the steps. Her cheek was bleeding. Her nose was bleeding. Her lips were bleeding. Her neck hurt, but ah, God, her shoulder was the worst, humped all up, crooked in a way she remembered well. The last time she'd seen a hump like that, it had been in a red nylon Wildcats jersey. Nevertheless, she struggled to her feet, thanking God she still had the power to command her legs. She could also have been paralyzed. She'd lost hold of the leash halfway down, and Clover jumped at Thibodeau, his teeth snapping at the chest and belly under his shirt, tearing the shirt open, knocking Thibodeau backward, going for the young man's vitals.
"Get him off me!" Carter screamed.
Nothing calm about him now.
"He's gonna kill me!"
And, yes, Clover was trying. His front paws were planted on Carter's thighs, going up and down as Carter thrashed. He looked like a German shepherd on a bicycle. He shifted his angle of attack and bit deep into Carter's shoulder, eliciting another scream. Then Clover went for the throat. Carter got his hands on the dog's chest, just in time to save his windpipe.
"Make him stop!"
Frank reached for the trailing leash. Clover turned and snapped at his fingers. Frank skittered backward, and Clover returned his attention to the man who had pushed his mistress down the steps. His muzzle opened, revealing a double line of shining white teeth, and he drove at Thibodeau's neck. Carter got his hand up, then shrieked in agony as Clover seized on it and began to shake it like one of his beloved rag toys. Only his rag toys didn't bleed, and Carter's hand did. Piper came staggering up the steps, holding her left arm across her midriff. Her face was a mask of blood. A tooth clung to the corner of her mouth like a crumb of food.
"Get him off me! Christ, get your fucking dog off me!"
Piper was opening her mouth to tell Clover to stand down when she saw Fred Denton drawing his gun.
"No," she screamed. "No, I can make him stop."
Fred turned to Mel Searles and pointed at the dog with his free hand. Mel stepped forward and kicked Clover in the haunch. He did it high and hard, as he had once, not so long ago, punted footballs. Clover was whipped sideways, losing his hold on Thibodeau's bleeding, shredded hand, where two fingers now pointed in unusual directions, like crooked signposts.
"No!"
Piper screamed again, so loud and so hard the world went gray before her eyes.
"Don't hurt my dog!"
Fred paid no attention. When Peter Randolph burst out through the double doors, his shirt tail out, his pants unzipped, the copy of Outdoors he had been reading on the crapper still held in one hand, Fred paid no attention to that either. He pointed his service automatic at the dog and fired. The sound was deafening in the enclosed square. The top of Clover's head lifted off in a spray of blood and bone. He took one step towards his screaming, bleeding mistress. Another. Then collapsed. Fred
Gun still in hand, strode forward and grabbed Piper by her bad arm. The hump in her shoulder roared a protest. And still she kept her eyes on the corpse of her dog, whom she had raised from a pup.
You're under arrest.